It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. Yesterday morning, Madison city officials cleared the encampment that protesters formed on Williamson Street on Madison's east side near the intersection where 30-year-old Corey Ruiz was shot and killed by a police officer on July 22nd. The encampment had formed around a vigil site for Ruiz. Activists say it was a way to honor Ruiz and gather as a community to protest police violence. But some local businesses and residents raised concerns about noise levels, passability, and safety in the area. Protesters returned to the neighborhood overnight. In just a bit, we'll hear from a county supervisor who represents the district about what he's been seeing and hearing from constituents. First, Sarah Lear is with us, state government reporter for WPR, following last night's Madison Common Council meeting. It's the first time the council met since that shooting. Sarah, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
It seems like not a lot came out of that meeting in terms of decisions, more public comment. What did you see coming out of last night's meeting?
It was a very long meeting. It stretched for nearly 8 hours. More than 100 people registered for public comment. It was actually a virtual-only meeting, and that was because the city officials say that elected officials had received threats following the shooting. So it was overall a very tense meeting.
Yeah, tense. Can you give us more of a sense of the overall mood, which can be harder to judge in a virtual meeting than an in-person meeting, of course?
There was a lot of anger at the city, anger at the shooting itself, anger at the encampment being cleared, as well as, there's anger from people who believe the encampment went on too long. At one point during the meeting, Alder Barbara Harrington McKinney said maybe the meeting should be adjourned. She asked if they could legally do it because she said there were reports of what she described as craziness in the streets. And that came as there were fires being set at the site of the former encampment on Willie Street overnight. They didn't end up adjourning the meeting. They ended up continuing to take public comment. And Alder Carmela Glenn was kind of giving updates from the area of Willie Street. She was at the Social Justice Center in Madison, which is on Willie Street, just a few blocks from where the center of the encampment was at some point. And there is a big group of people with the local activist group Freedom Inc. who are calling into the meeting from the Social Justice Center.
I want to give a listen to one of the comments from the meeting last night. A constituent named Devin Snyder raising concerns about the police clearing of the protest encampment yesterday morning.
What I saw today, the disregard of property, the disregard of Black lives, community members mourning over excessive force, and then you, Mayor, come in and use excessive force on us community members?
Now, that mayor, Madison Mayor Satya Rhodes Conway, had released a video yesterday about the city's decision to disband the encampment at that intersection. Here's some of what she had to say.
The decision to invoke this option was not made lightly and was only made after almost 2 weeks of trying to resolve the situation peacefully and voluntarily with the people occupying the site.
Sarah, you were at the site of the former encampment yesterday morning. What kind of things did you see there?
So I saw forklifts and bulldozers and street sweepers going through the intersection, clearing it as people stood by and chanted. There were items from the memorial being packed up into boxes by street division workers who were taking it to Demitral Park, which is a nearby park. The city has says that artwork from the memorial is going to be preserved and that people have a chance to reclaim their personal items. One of the people actually at the site on Tuesday morning was Devin Snyder, who we heard from earlier. He's a member of the Police Civilian Oversight Board. And I did speak with him. He was among the people observing kind of the aftermath of the clearing.
What have you heard from protesters and people sympathetic to them about the significance of the memorial site and why they didn't want to see it taken down?
Throughout this situation, there have been demands from people at the encampment that there should be some type of permanent ongoing memorial to Corey Ruiz, and the mayor and other city officials say that they're committed to doing that. We don't know exactly what that will look like. I did speak yesterday with Madison Alder Davey Mayer, who represents the Near East Side where the shooting happened. He was at the park kind of supervising the situation as people were sorting through items from the memorial. And he says, the plan right now is to have a memorial, not just to Corey Ruiz, but to all people who have been killed by police. Madison's Willie Street neighborhood has actually been the site of two other police shootings since 2012.
And what has happened at the intersection since the clearing? Has it reopened? What happened overnight?
Well, officially, the city reopened the intersection about 9 a.m. Tuesday morning. But since then, cars have been driving through, but it's also been blocked at times by protesters who were swarming the intersection. Overnight, there were additional arrests. According to a Madison Fire spokesperson, protesters in hazmat suits and other gears went to the center of the intersection and refused to leave. According to this city spokesperson, there were a total of five fire sets, and she said people were dumping trash cans and dumpsters into the middle of the street. She did say that police eventually cleared the intersection. It's since been reopened. She said that police did use pepper spray on one protester while clearing the intersection at one point on Tuesday, but she said overnight there was not the use of tear gas, and she said that pepper spray was not used on a widespread basis.
Sarah, thanks for bringing us up to date.
Absolutely.
That's Sarah Lear, WPR reporter, giving us updates from last night's Madison Common Council meeting and the disbanding of a barricaded protest site on Williamson Street in Madison yesterday morning. Now for more on what's going on in the neighborhood where this is all happening, we're joined by Yogesh Chawla. He represents District 6 on the Dane County Board of Supervisors. That includes Madison's Near East Side, where the shooting happened and the protest site was built. Supervisor Chawla, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
This, as we said, part of your district. What were you hearing from your constituents in the lead up to the city's removal of the barricades yesterday?
You know, prior to this, the mayor did ask for the occupation, and as did I and Alder Mayor. And what we were seeing was increasingly a public safety and a public health problem. There was a lot of tension between neighbors and people at the encampment. There was a growing population of unhoused people who needed services. We did see, you know, just tension building, and there was a really fragile peace that was there, and it was hard to maintain that 24/7. So yesterday I woke up to the sounds from my house, and I went, just like everyone else, and checked my feeds, and I saw that the clearing was happening.
What are you looking for next for the people who are at that encampment? And as you say, many without housing, looking for a place to live. What are you watching for the aftermath for them?
You know, the city really worked hard on providing temporary housing for those affected, and not only temporary housing, but supportive services around that. It's not enough just to house somebody. You want to put them in a position to be successful. In addition to that, I was on site with Alder Mayor at Demitral Field, and we were helping folks get their belongings. The city parks is still there until noon today, facilitating that process. They're also covering all the items with tarps as well, and they also provided special gloves to handle in case there were sharps there, because there were some of that mixed in. And then we also made sure the George Floyd Memorial that was there was barricaded away, and then that was put into the hands of trusted custodians who, with consultation with the activists and organizers there.
Now, you mentioned safety concerns here. I think the protesters themselves, people sympathetic to them, are concerned that this police shooting will be forgotten, swept under the rug over time. What do you say to their concerns?
You know, right now we have like a really immediate tense situation in the neighborhood. You know, there was the reoccupation last night. There was some fires set. And the thing I want to say is accountability and justice is our number one priority. And there is work to be done on that on the city level, the county level, also to change a lot of the state laws that are out there and a lot of the culture around what has happened with police accountability and police community relations and community control over police. So that's not a problem the city of Madison alone can solve, and they can certainly not solve that problem overnight.
That said, what are first steps you'd like to see along those lines?
You know, I think last night at the city council meeting, you saw support for the Police Civilian Oversight Board, the Office of the Independent Monitor. I think that's immediate things that the city can do right now. when we look at, you know, accountability, that really starts with our district attorney as well, who has had a lot of officer-involved shootings under his, while he has been in office, and he has not charged any of those. So I think making sure we have that independent investigation from DCI that gets referred over to the district attorney's office, and the district attorney really takes those charges, but takes that situation seriously and acts accordingly.
Now, in the aftermath, businesses in the neighborhood concerned shut down or business very much restricted during the encampment, graffiti, some damage remaining. What are you watching for when it comes to now cleaning up and getting things back to normal standard operating procedure for businesses in that neighborhood?
Yeah, you know, a lot of the businesses we talked to, we've met with them for hours and hours over the last couple of weeks. They're down to 15% of their sales. You know, a lot of the people who live in the neighborhood work at those businesses. They're losing wages. They're concerned whether or not they can make their rent, whether or not they can pay their mortgage. And, you know, we have a hotel in the area as well where summer is their busiest season. And, you know, we're really concerned about whether or not they can survive. We set up a GoFundMe. We're asking people to, you know, they're asking people to buy gift certificates as well. But it's really hard, you know, to really turn that around and provide that, you know, support for them like what used to be there. So we're going to do everything we can to really help our neighbors.
Supervisor Chavla, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
That's Yogesh Chavla, who represents District 6 on the Dane County Board of Supervisors. That includes Madison's Near East Side. We also heard from Sarah Lear, reporter for WPR, and getting the latest updates after city officials cleared the memorial site for Corey Ruiz yesterday morning, about 2 weeks after he was shot by a Madison police officer. Coming up, as Medicaid work requirements kick in next year, Wisconsin could see thousands of people lose Badger Care coverage. Find out what that could mean for people and for hospitals in the state.
What many health economists anticipate is that as Medicaid coverage drops, we're going to see more uncompensated care, more charity care, more bad debt.
That's next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. A tornado with wind speeds up to 140 miles per hour ripped through the Fox Valley last week, leaving catastrophic damage to homes and businesses in its wake. As Joe Schultz reports, the community is in the early stages of what's expected to be a long recovery effort.
Menasha resident Chris Silver was working in Sturgeon Bay when an EF3 tornado struck around noon last Monday. His 12-year-old son was still at home. As the storm blew through, Silver raced through debris and down power lines to get back to him. All he could think about was making sure his son was okay.
He hid in the basement. I just got through going under all these electrical wires in my work vehicle to see my kid. How did these other people feel? They were home. Praise the Lord. We're okay.
Silver's home is located in an especially hard-hit neighborhood near Plank Road and Manderfield's Bakery. Silver says it's one of the few on the block that hasn't been ripped to shreds.
I feel absolutely terrible for my neighbors. They're picking through their stuff, their whole lives, everything, their kids' clothes, and it's gone. Our whole neighborhood, it's gone.
As he spoke, Silver looked out on almost unimaginable destruction. Some homes were completely gone. All that was left were scattered piles of lumber, drywall, and insulation. Others were shifted off foundations or left with walls torn away to reveal rooms inside. A neighborhood that had been untouched that morning was now a sea of debris. The National Weather Service says the tornado developed over Appleton around noon and tracked south for 12 miles before dissipating over Lake Winnebago. Menasha and Fox Crossing were the hardest hit communities. Governor Tony Evers declared a state of emergency and deployed the Wisconsin National Guard. More than 50 service members have been sent to assist in Menasha, Nina, and Fox Crossing. Winnebago County Executive Gordon Hintz made the request.
National Guard exists to help sustain recovery efforts, and so they're really partners in the process.
Dozens of buildings were destroyed, and even more sustained serious damage. Despite the level of destruction, there were no fatalities or serious injuries. In the days immediately after the storm, Menasha Mayor Austin Hammond urged those who do not live in affected areas to stay away.
If you don't need to be in the city of Menasha, please don't. Residents in our community are going through some of the darkest moments of their life right now.
Emergency management officials are conducting damage assessments this week to try to quantify the scale of destruction. That's part of the process of gathering information to make a request for federal disaster relief. Menasha resident Douglas Johnson was visiting his mother in Appleton when the storm hit. He came home to find his house on 3rd Street torn to pieces. The house was leaning off its foundation, the front wall ripped off. Part of the second floor had collapsed.
The whole top of it's gone. Everything else is gone inside. It's like it was gutted out by wind.
Other nearby buildings were completely destroyed. As he spoke, he looked toward what had been his neighbor's home.
You can see it's just one big pile. That was a house.
While Johnson wasn't home when the tornado hit, his dog was.
She crawled underneath the crawl space in my bed, and that's where we found her. She's alive.
Down the street, Wayne Bokelman's home suffered major storm damage as well. He also wasn't home when the tornado ripped through.
I was at work. My wife called and said the house was like a train. And then it got calm, and then she came upstairs and she said there's just water all over and part of the roof was gone.
Even though his house was badly damaged, Bokelman says the storm didn't take everything.
What we're doing now is we're just getting some pictures that mean something and some clothes, and we're going to probably stay down by my sister in Oshkosh.
Chris Silver, who drove through the storm to get to his son, was still reeling in the hours after making it home.
I don't care about any of this stuff. That could be replaced. But my family, my community, we need help.
The cleanup is expected to take time, but officials say they've seen a groundswell of support. More than 3,000 volunteers showed up on Saturday alone. Joe Schultz, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is WPR News. Last week, the Wisconsin Department of Health Services announced that more than 60,000 of the 200,000 people enrolled in Badger Care are at risk of losing their insurance at the start of next year. That program provides free or low-cost government health insurance for those with limited income, pregnant women, children, or people with disabilities. The One Big Beautiful Bill Act passed by Congress last year imposes a new work requirement for many people on Medicaid. The state doesn't have work history on file for tens of thousands of people on Wisconsin's version of Medicaid. So if they don't certify their employment, they would lose coverage. Dan Sachs is a professor of risk management and insurance in the Wisconsin School of Business. He joins us to talk about the potential impacts and what people on Badger Care need to know. Dan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We have this change now in Medicaid with the work requirements. In Wisconsin, we're talking about Badger Care. If I have that right, it gets a little twisty, attorney. Who is in danger potentially of losing health care coverage because of this change?
So the work requirements apply to Badger Care members who are childless adults and not disabled, not elderly.
And what kind of proof, or do we know this yet, what kind of proof does that person, again, in that category, have to give to say, hey, I'm meeting those requirements, either through education, work, or volunteer hours?
Yeah, so you need to demonstrate 20 hours a week of community engagement, exactly as you said, through work, education, or some kind of community service. If you're employed and your employer handles your payroll through something like ADP or an automatic processor, very likely the state already knows that you're employed and you won't have to do anything. But if you get paid in cash or you're self-employed or you have a less formal arrangement, you're going to have to demonstrate to DHS, to your caseworker, evidence of your employment. And that could mean showing bank accounts or the deposits. It could mean other paperwork.
And that takes us to the state DHS. The Secretary Kirsten Johnson told reporters last week that Wisconsin currently has no work history for around 63,000 Medicaid recipients. What do you make of that number? Do you expect that's mostly people who are not working or potentially people who just don't have documentation that backs up that they're meeting those requirements?
Well, it's probably a mix of both. I mean, certainly some Medicaid members are sick. All of them, to be eligible, are low income. So many of them, particularly younger ones, may not have any work history at all. But it's definitely true. Many people work in less formal roles with less electronic records that are available to the state.
This goes into effect next year. What are you watching for as states like Wisconsin get ready to get the word out and see if people meet these requirements to help people stay on, or if people aren't eligible, take them off the lists?
Well, one of the big questions right now is how people can establish medical frailty. So the law allows for a medical frailty exemption, meaning if you have a medical frailty, you don't have to work and you don't have to meet these work requirements. States expected that they would be able to certify people as medically frail based on the health records that the Medicaid program already has. But recent rulings from the Trump administration indicated that everyone might need essentially a doctor's note to get a medical frailty exemption. There's a lawsuit going on now challenging that regulation, and I'm paying close attention to how that lawsuit progresses.
So that sounds like potentially a catch-22. I can't afford to go to a doctor. How do I go to a doctor to get this certifying letter that says I have a need to go to a doctor to get this kind of coverage?
Well, it definitely makes it harder to establish medical frailty, but I wouldn't put it quite that extremely because everyone that we're talking about here has Medicaid, and Medicaid doesn't require any kind of cost sharing to go to the doctor. You might not be able to get a doctor's appointment, but if you can get one, you won't have to pay for it.
Right. But if I don't have, if I'm trying to establish my eligibility for Medicaid, I might not have that free trip to the doctor or the compensated trip to the doctor.
Oh, I see. So most of what we're worried about here is current members losing their eligibility rather than new members establishing eligibility. That's probably going to be a problem going forward, that now there's an additional box you have to check to establish eligibility of either you meet the work requirements or you're medically exempt. I think the state will have to confront that over the next years and beyond. But there's quite a lot of people over the next several months who are going to be subject to these rules as members.
And then that medical frailty question. In some of the reporting I've seen on this, one example was a woman who'd had a cancer diagnosis, an active cancer diagnosis. That would have counted for medical frailty. She'd been through treatment in remission. The concern that she had was, now that I'm in remission, do I still meet that medical frailty requirement, even though I may need further treatment? I might not magically instantly be able to go back to work. Are there going to be, do you expect a lot of gray areas where people might find it difficult to work in their condition, but might not meet that medical frailty exemption?
Yeah, I think there certainly will be gray areas. Certainly, the law and the regulations that have come out create a lot of ambiguity about what will count. I think it is unambiguous that a doctor's note will count, mm-hmm. but that places a burden on patients and on providers to go and get that note. And anything short of that is potentially ambiguous until kind of we get clarity around how the states can proceed with their medical records.
Now, the whole notion, the whole argument behind the work requirement from supporters is, hey, if people are able-bodied, they're able to work, we want them working and not using this program that is designed for someone else. I don't know how easy it is to put numbers on this. Do we have a sense of how much of current, say, Badger Care recipients or Medicaid recipients nationwide are in that category who would be affected by this?
So like you mentioned, the state has estimated that something like 60,000 members might be at immediate risk of losing coverage because they don't have a work history. You know, from the numbers that I've looked at, something like half of Medicaid members in this category, non-disabled, are not currently working. I would say there's two parts to complying with this. One is actually working. The other is documenting that you're working and convincing the state, and that adds an additional burden, you know, particularly if you're working much of the time. States vary in how easy they make that process. So, you know, states can lean into kind of automatic certification and allowing for multiple modes of certification, so through websites, through visiting the county office, or states can make it really hard and have a hotline that you have to call that's only running for 2 hours a day. Wisconsin seems to be trying to make it easier, as easy as they're allowed, to let people certify.
Now, a common concern with meeting requirements such as this is, okay, somebody works in an office 20 hours a week. They're through a payroll provider system. Easy peasy. You can imagine somebody who paints houses, you know, right, with a guy who runs a crew a lot in the summer, less in the winter. They don't have a payroll provider. They may be paid casually or, you know, without a lot of formal documentation. Is there a concern that, hey, this person is technically meeting these requirements and the certification is difficult or impossible to provide?
Absolutely. So I've seen cases where if you're self-employed, especially, there's no one to vouch on your behalf. And then this I'm more familiar with from the SNAP program, the food stamp program. You might have to keep a log of your business activities and show that to your caseworker, essentially, to demonstrate your availability. So it's a lot of tracking.
Talking to Dan Sachs, professor of risk management and insurance in the Wisconsin School of Business, talking about Medicaid work requirements beginning at the start of next year. Over 60,000 Wisconsinites could lose their health coverage, according to recent Wisconsin DHS numbers. Looking away from the individuals receiving this to the system as a whole, if we take probably not all 60,000 people, but a goodly number, thousands of people off of Medicaid, off of Badger Care at once in Wisconsin, what could that mean for the healthcare providers who treat them, who rely on that as part of their income stream, in effect?
Well, there's going to be two kinds of disruption. A lot of preventive and primary care patients won't be getting anymore. That's worse for the patients. And in fact, there's very good evidence that Medicaid coverage like this saves people's lives. It's also disruptive for the providers, as you've said. There's less revenue for them. But the other kind of disruption is that many of these patients will continue to get care, particularly care in the emergency room. Emergency departments have a legal obligation to provide care regardless of ability to pay. What we saw in the last decade plus of Medicaid expansion is that hospitals were having to provide less and less charity care, and they were writing off less and less bad debt because there were more people covered. What many health economists anticipate is that as Medicaid coverage drops, we're going to see a reversal of that trend and likely more uncompensated care, more charity care, more bad debt.
Happening at the same time, we're seeing fewer people enrolling under the Affordable Care Act because of premium increases or the end of premium subsidies, in effect, meaning people have to pay more this year than last year. Do you see that potentially compounding that problem of this uncompensated care at hospitals?
Yeah, it's the same trend that there is fewer and fewer people insured. And I have seen reporting that there's more uncompensated care happening that puts more strain on hospitals. Typically, it's the same hospitals that are serving the Medicaid population and the relatively low income population on the exchanges. As a result, those hospitals are likely going to be in more financial stress.
So looking ahead now to 2027, these changes kick into effect. What will you be watching for as we start to see how many people are losing Badger Care in Wisconsin? How many people are potentially seeking uncompensated care? What are the big question marks for you?
The first question is, exactly as you said, what's going to happen to enrollment in Badger Care? We'll be able to see that probably starting in March or a little later. That'll get reported out. I think a related question is what's happening to employment and are people actually responding to these work requirements? And then, you know, a few months after that, I think we'll be interested to see what happens to hospital finances.
Right. The what happens to employment, the intent or the stated intent of rules like this is, hey, we're going to motivate people to go out and get at least that 20 hours of work of 20 hours of work per week or education or volunteer. Do we have a track record on the success of that kind of incentive? Does it seem to drive people into the labor market who wouldn't have been otherwise?
There are a couple of states that have implemented early versions of these work requirements. It's not exactly the same set of members that were subject to them. Arkansas is the best studied example, and that was not effective in increasing employment.
Now, another issue for personal costs of medications is or of healthcare is medication. We're seeing some changes from the Trump administration there, an end to some subsidies for insurance companies to provide lower cost medications to seniors. I think I summed that up succinctly. And then down the road, this is a couple years off, anticipated tariffs on generic medications, already some tariffs kicking in on brand name medications. How much does the cost of medication affect people's risk of having to pay a lot for their health care and their ability to pay for it?
So medications are an important part of healthcare spending, although not the biggest part. The hospitals are the biggest part. Medications are, for many people on chronic medications, a regular recurring expense. They contribute to the overall premium of health insurance, the cost of medications, and for people who have Medicare Part D plans, which are the area where these subsidies were recently repealed, the entirety of the premium is driven by the cost of the insurers of acquiring drugs.
And finally, on the cost side of healthcare, there's been a lot of questions about, hey, can we lower what we pay for healthcare, what costs are going into it, no matter who's paying, whether it's out of my pocket or my insurers or the federal government or whatever the case may be. Do you have your eye on anything that's going to make the delivery of healthcare more sort of less expensive, regardless of who is writing the checks for it?
Well, much of why healthcare costs so much, why we spend so much on it, is the price of healthcare. We pay much more for things like an MRI or a hospital encounter than many peer nations. And economists believe a key contributing factor to the price of healthcare is the market power of hospitals and hospital systems. So over the last 10, 20 years, there's been a lot of consolidation in the healthcare sector. We've seen more and more kind of mega systems grow. That has surely pushed up the price of healthcare, pushed up premiums that everyone pays. And there's opportunities for antitrust enforcement to push back against some of that. I think that's a key lever available to us.
Dan, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Dan Sachs is a professor of risk management and insurance in the Wisconsin School of Business. We talked to them about the new Medicaid work requirements being implemented at the start of next year, when more than 60,000 Wisconsinites could lose their health coverage. Coming up, hear the story of Old World Wisconsin as it marks its 50th anniversary of preserving 19th century immigrant buildings and the stories of the people who lived and worked in them.
It provides individuals with the opportunity to immerse themselves in the 19th century.
That's next here on WPR News. This is Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about some memorable bartenders.
Wisconsin has one of the highest concentrations of bartenders in the country, with more than 24,000 people working behind a bar. And a good percentage of them are women. But as writer Patty C. tells us, that hasn't always been the case.
Few of us bar lovers realize it took until 1970 for women to legally tend bar in major U.S. cities. The only exception was if they were the wives or daughters of male owners. Over four centuries ago, British pubs were often run by women. In the New World, Puritan-influenced blue laws were enacted to protect ladies from taverns full of drunken men fighting with swords and guns, not to mention their vulgar language, gambling, and overflowing spittoons. History professor Madeline Powers, author of Faces Along the Bar, claimed that drinking establishments offered alternative entrances for Victorian-era women so they didn't have to pass through the front bar room, which was still undisputed male territory. In later eras, saloons filled with women often meant money was made the old-fashioned way. I'm not talking about Wisconsin's favorite mixed drink. After World War II, registered nurse Joyce Connolly and her Navy pilot husband Hank planned to open a grocery store in western Wisconsin. Instead, in 1950, the couple bought a building and transformed it into Glenlock Bar on Chippewa Falls' north side. Joyce was 7 months pregnant, and the couple had 3 and 5-year-old daughters. Hank did the heavy lifting in the bar, replacing kegs from the ice house down the road, while Joyce says, "I was behind the bar all the time." She put their children to bed before the nightly rush. This beer bar catered to 18 to 20-year-olds.
Sometimes parents came in to check out the spot kids flocked to for Leinenkugels, hot beefs, and French fries, the entire menu. Our customers were wonderful, Joyce says. She is 98 now and continues to live in Chippewa Falls. When I was a kid in the late 1970s, my family frequented our neighborhood tavern below Holy Ghost Hill in Chippewa Falls. Francis Tootie Wilson bought the Plunkett Inn and changed its name to Tootie's. She was a fixture there. Another bar owner once challenged Tootie to a wrestling match in a kiddie pool filled with pudding. I hope photos of that event still exist somewhere. Sunday afternoons, my dad often drove our family 60 minutes to Jump River Rose's Deer Farm and Supper Club, where Rose Wawrzyniak let customers pet her tamed fawn inside her tavern. One patron remembered Rosie as a lady who could smoke a cigar, tend a bar, milk cows, go out logging or hunting, and then listen to your troubles over a beer. She'd also spent time as a bull rider and stock car driver and later ran for Russ County Sheriff. Paramount Pictures paid Rosie in advance for a film based on her life. Because of people like Joyce, Tootie, Rosie, and many others, today women make up 61% of all bartenders in the U.S., though they still don't purchase bars as often as men. Back in the 1950s, Glenlock co-owner Joyce Connolly often fretted when patrons nicknamed her tavern Hank's. She recently joked, "All the work I did, and they never called it Joyce's."
Patty C. is a writer from Lake Halley, Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowland Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. The technical producer for this story was Sarah Hopeful. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is WPR News. Nestled across 600 acres of countryside in the Kettle Moraine State Forest, you'll find a slice of Wisconsin history that takes you back to the 19th century. This year, Old World Wisconsin marks its 50th anniversary as a place for restoring and preserving historic cabins and buildings and telling the stories of the people who lived in them. Over the past half century, the site has expanded to add more buildings along with hands-on immersive history with experiences like blacksmithing and beer brewing. Here to help take us back to the 1800s and showcase how preservation efforts have evolved, we have Old World Wisconsin director Doug Rainey. Doug, thanks for joining us.
It's wonderful to be here. Thank you, Rob.
Well, Old World Wisconsin helps us learn about history. It also has a history. Can you tell us the origin story? Take us back 50 years to the birth of Old World Wisconsin.
Yeah, it's really an amazing story. The story began really in the 1960s. When a Wisconsin architect by the name of Richard Perrin, he noticed that many of the state's early immigrants' homes and farms and community buildings were fast disappearing. And Perrin believed that these early buildings really needed to be preserved and protected. And so he found a fellow preservation fan in Hans Kreuther. He also believed in saving these original buildings. And at the same time, the Wisconsin Historical Society was exploring the idea of creating a living history museum that would tell the story of immigrant communities across the state. And so they all teamed up together, and the idea of Old World Wisconsin was born.
It born and it grew. Can you compare the experience of Old World Wisconsin now to those early days? What do we see now versus then?
Yeah, after years and years of planning, and they opened up Old World Wisconsin officially on June 30th of 1976. So it was in conjunction with the bicentennial at that particular point. Now, they had 8,000 to 12,000 visitors that were there during the opening celebration, and they had just a few buildings, on site and that were in different states of construction. I think only about four were completed at that particular point. Now we have over 60 plus buildings across 600 acres here in the Kettle Moraine Forest.
And how many visitors do you tend to get there nowadays?
Our visitation for the entire year is about 60 to 70,000 people per year. And that includes families and schools and guests that come from all over the state and all over the country.
You mentioned these are original buildings. These are not models or, you know, reconstructions of what they might have been like. These are the original things. What does it take to build, you know, something an immigrant family might have built by hand 80 years before moving? What does it take to bring that from point A to point B?
Yeah, the majority of our buildings are original. And so, in other words, they were taken apart or they were separated and moved here to the site. We do have a few reconstruction here on site. So for example, the Wheelman's Club. We also have, of course, our brand new visitor center, the Brew House. Those are reconstructions. But a lot of our buildings, especially across the site in the homesteads, are actual original buildings from the original time that they were built.
And right, for moving these, what kind of painstaking work? I assume it's you take it apart, you label all the parts so you can put it back together again. It's a little trickier than an IKEA fix.
Yeah, one of the best examples of that is actually the general store that is located in Crossroads Village. And that was built in 1876 by Griffin Thomas. That building was painstakingly taken apart stone by stone by stone. And each of those stones were numbered. And if you look really closely around that particular building, oftentimes you can actually, in certain places, still see some of those numbers. When they brought it back to the site, it was put back together painstakingly following those directions and following those numbers.
And what kind of things do we learn about not just the buildings, but the people who lived in them, all the different immigrants who experienced 19th century life in Wisconsin?
Yeah, I think that's what's so amazing is the stories. It's the story of the building, the architecture that's involved with creating those particular building, but of course the story of the immigrants that lived in those particular buildings. And, you know, our wonderful interpreters and facilitators do a great job of really giving visitors here the context for those particular stories. And oftentimes our visitors that come now find themselves in those stories and maybe in their family stories.
Doug Rainey is with us, director of Old World Wisconsin. We're talking about the 50th anniversary of Old World Wisconsin this year and some new looks, new facilities there. Doug, you mentioned that Welcome Center, a big part of that expansion. What does that add to the visitor experience?
Yeah, we really wanted to make sure that we improved the visitor welcome experience. We've been calling it the arrival experience. And that really has remained unchanged for about 50 years. And so right around 2010, as many people know, we had a tornado that went through Eagle here, and it took down a tremendous amount of trees. Luckily, it did very little damage to the actual site and to the structures on the site. But it really opened up, especially the area around what would become the green or the welcome area for the site. And that really started this idea working in about 2017 to 2020 to really start to look at what the welcome experience or the arrival experience could be. So we created a brand new brew house that was opened in 2022. And then related to that, we opened the Whitnables a tavern. And that was opened in May of 2025, along with the corresponding beer garden. That surrounding the green, along with the Clausing Cafe and Event Center, Barn, and the new Welcome Center, really creates this one-of-a-kind welcome experience for our guests.
The Brew House, it features for the anniversary a historic recipe called Old World Wisconsin Gold. What's the story behind that recipe?
Yeah, so that's the actual 1948 Schlitz brand or recipe. And in that particular case, we worked with the Wisconsin Brewing Company to develop our 50th anniversary brew.
And there's also, I understand, some blacksmithing going on. I'm always a sucker for that. Tell us about that part of the experience.
Absolutely. So a lot of activity happens in all of our different areas. But in Crossroads Village, we have the blacksmith shop. And this shop is a phenomenal place. It's one that many of our visitors love to go to and they talk a lot about. And in that particular case, the blacksmith shop was built in 1886. And it really was, the actual building was built to replace the original shop, which, and the house and barn that was actually burnt down in a fire from the original owner. And it's an area where individuals can come in. Oftentimes we get at least one forge. We have two forges and can get them up and going. And people love the activity, love the opportunity to get involved with the blowers and actually help our blacksmiths do their work. Also, the opportunity to get something using the time tokens from the blacksmith shop, along with 4 Mile House and also the general store.
Going back to the houses, how much are you able to learn about the history of those houses and the actual families that lived in them versus, you know, this is a generic Scandinavian family home? How much can you tell about the people who were in those houses?
A great deal. With of obviously the development of Old World Wisconsin, we have old records, records not only of the buildings themselves, but the individuals that lived in those buildings. And so we have an awful lot of information. And Jennifer Melka, who is our collections specialist, does a fantastic job of categorizing that and working and saving those particular records. In fact, as part of the 50th anniversary, we have developed a 50th exhibit, anniversary exhibit, and that is located in the Luskow House. And visitors that come to the site can experience that as part of their exploration time here when they visit.
And Doug, as we wrap up, what do you see as the value for people today of having this window into our state's past?
I think individuals have an opportunity to explore what it was like to live in the past. What I really love is to watch families come here and them being multi-generational. And actually, there's kids, grandkids, grandparents, sometimes even great-grandparents. And to watch that interaction, watch that communication and those stories, not only our stories, but their family stories come out. And, you know, some of those individuals might have actually used some of the objects or experienced some of the actual buildings that we have here on site when they were kids. And to watch them share that with their family and their grandkids is really super special.
Doug, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Rob.
Doug Rainey is the director at Old World Wisconsin. We've been talking about Old World Wisconsin turning 50 this year and efforts to preserve the state's history. Next week on the show, we'll meet a Wisconsin farmer who's aiming to build closer connection with food consumers in the state. And we want to hear from you about the way you buy your food. Do you have opportunities to buy food directly from local producers? That could be a farmer's market, a CSA program, or maybe pick your own strawberries, apples, or other produce. And if you do that, what is it that appeals to you about getting your food that way? Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text us. That number is 888-642-0232. And if you sell produce at farmers markets through CSAs or in a stand by your farm, love to hear from you too. Again, email wisconsintoday@wpr.org or call or text at 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Trevor Hook, Joe Tarr, and Rochelle Wilson. Our technical directors are Brad Kohlberg and Sarah Hopeful. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.